In vain Mani assured her that he had positively seen it precisely like that with the eyes of his dream, and that its clarity had been full of meaning which cried out for interpretation. In vain he spoke of his inner threat, of the harm which might come to the teaching, in other words, to Aton, if the dream were to interpret itself unhindered, that is to say, be fulfilled and take the actual shape of which it had been the prophetic garment. He had again the impression that at bottom his mother had no heart for his god, that it was only with her reason, namely on political and dynastic grounds, that she sided with him. She had always supported her son in his tender love, his spiritual passion for Aton, but again today, as for a long time, he saw, and thanks to his sensitiveness he always saw, that she did it only out of calculation, exploiting his heart as a woman would who saw the whole world exclusively from the point of view of statesmanship, and not, as he did, from the religious first and foremost. That troubled Mani and wounded him. He left his mother, having heard from her that if he really thought his cow and corn vision important to the state, he could apply to Ptah-Imheb, the vizier of the south, at the morning audience. Besides, there was no dearth of dream interpreters on the spot. He had already sent for the interpreters, and now impatiently awaited them. But before receiving them, he had to see the great official who came to report on the affairs of the Red House, in other words, the business of the treasury of Lower Egypt. Immediately after the greeting hymns, Mani interrupted him and made him listen to the story of the dreams, related in nervous, tormented tones. Hesitating, seeking for the right words, he demanded that the man express himself on two points. First, whether he, like his master, considered the narrative to have political significance, and second, if so, in what way and what connection. The official did not know what to answer, or rather, he had answered in a lengthy speech of very well-turned phrases that he did not know how to answer, and did not know what to say about the dreams, after which he had tried to return to treasury business. But Amenhotep kept him to the subject of the dreams, obviously unwilling and unable to talk about anything else or listen to it, only to want to make him understand how speakingly impressive or impressively speaking they were. And he did not leave off until the wise men and seers were announced. The king, full of his night's experience, indeed possessed by it as he now was, turned his levee into a first-class ceremony. And yet, after all, it turned out to be a lamentable failure. He not only ordered Ptah-Imheb to remain present, but also arranged that all the court dignitaries who had accompanied him to On should attend the audience of interpretation. There were some dozen high-ranking gentlemen, the great steward of the palace, the keeper of the king's wardrobe, the overseer of the fullers, the so-called sandal-bearer of the king, a considerable office, the head wig-keeper of the god, who was likewise guardian of the enchanted empires, in other words, of the two crowns, and privy counselor of the royal jewels, the groom of all Pharaoh's horses, the new head baker and prince of Menphe, named Amenemopet, the first steward of the buffet, Nefer-Emwese, once temporarily called Bin-Emwese, and several fan-bearers on the right hand of the god. All these had to be present in the audience and council hall. They stood round in two groups on either hand of Pharaoh's splendid seat, which was on a raised dais under a baldachin borne by slender, beribboned poles. The prophets and dream interpreters were brought before him, six in number, all of whom were in more or less close relation with the temple of the Horizon Dweller, and of whom a few had taken part in the Phoenix Council of the day before. People of their sort no longer prostrated themselves on their bellies to kiss the ground, as had once been the custom, before the throne chair. It was still the same chair as in the time of the pyramid builders, and even much earlier, a box-like armchair with a low back and a cushion on the floor in front. Only there was rather more ornamentation than in primitive times. But even although the chair had become more splendid, and Pharaoh more mighty, one no longer kissed the ground before them. Here, as in the case of the living burial of the court in the dead king's tomb, it was no longer good ton. The soothsayers merely lifted their arms in reverential wise and murmured in rather unrhythmical confusion a long formula of respect and greeting, wherein they assured the king that he had a form like his father, Re, and illumined the two lands with his beauty. For the radiance of his majesty penetrated into the dungeons, and there was no place which escaped the piercing glance of his eye, nor one whither the fine hearing of his million ears did not reach. He heard and saw all, and whatsoever issued from his mouth was like the words of Horus in the horizon, as his tongue was the scale of the world, and his lips more precise than the little tongue on the just scale of Tot. He was Re in all his members, they said in uneven and confused chorus, and Kepere in true form, the living image of his father Atum of On in Lower Egypt, O Nefer, Keperu, Re Wanre, Lord of Beauty, through whom we breathe. Some of them finished before the others. Then they were all silent and listened. Amenhotep thanked them, told them first in general on what occasion he had called them together, and then began, before this assemblage of some 20, either elegant or learned persons, to relate his egregious dream for the fourth time. It was painful to him. He flushed and floundered as he spoke. His insistent sense of the portentous significance of his tale had decided him to make it public. Now he regretted the decision, for he did not conceal from himself that what had been, and to him still was, so serious, sounded laughable when he repeated it aloud. Really, why should such fine fat cattle let such miserable weak ones calmly eat them up? Why and how should one set of ears of corn devour another set? But it had been so to him in his dream, so and not otherwise. The dreams had been fresh, lifelike, and impressive at night. By day, and put into words, they were like badly prepared mummies with distorted features. Nobody could want to reveal them. He was embarrassed, and came laboriously to an end. Then he looked shyly and expectantly at the dream-seers. They had nodded their heads meaningfully, but gradually, one after another, they stopped nodding and began a side-to-side motion, a series of wondering head-shakes. These were very singular and almost unique dreams, they explained through their elders. The interpretation was not easy. Not that they despaired of it. The dream was still to be dreamed that they could not expound. But they must ask for time to consider, and the favor of withdrawing for counsel. And compendiums must be fetched for consultation. There was nobody so learned as to have the whole technique at his fingers' ends. To be learned, they permitted themselves to remark, did not mean to have all knowledge in their heads. There would not be room for it. No, it meant to be in possession of the books in which the knowledge was written, and that they were. Amenhotep granted them leave to take counsel. The court was told to hold itself in readiness. The king spent 2 whole hours, the wait lasted that long, very restlessly. Then the sitting was resumed. May Pharaoh live 100 years, beloved of Ma'at, Lady of Truth, in response to his love of her who was without guile. She stood in person at the side of the experts as they pronounced their results and brought their interpretation before Pharaoh, protector of the truth. In the first place, the 7 fat kine meant 7 princesses. Which Nefer Nefruaton Nofertiti, the queen of the lands, would in time bear. But that the fat kine had been devoured by the lean ones meant that these 7 daughters would all die in Pharaoh's lifetime. That did not mean, they hastened to add, that the king's daughters would die young. To Pharaoh would be vouchsafed such a length of days that he would outlive all his children, however long they lived. Amenhotep looked at them open-mouthed. What were they talking about? He asked them in a diminished voice. They answered, it had been granted them to deliver the meaning of the first dream. But this interpretation, he had responded in a still smaller voice, had no sort of reference to his dream. It simply had nothing to do with it. He had not asked them whether the queen would bear him a son and successor, or a daughter and more daughters. He had asked them for the interpretation of the sleek and the ill-favored kine. The daughters, they replied, were the interpretation. He should not expect to find cows in the interpretation of a dream about cows. In the interpretation, the cows were turned into princesses. Pharaoh no longer had his mouth open. He had it very tightly closed, and opened it only a very little when he ordered them to go on to the second dream. Very well, the second, they said. The 7 full ears were 7 flourishing cities which Pharaoh would build, but the 7 shrunk and scrubby ones were the ruins of them. It was well known, they hastily explained, that all cities inevitably fell into ruins in time. Pharaoh himself would survive so long that he would see with his own eyes the ruins of the cities he had built. But here, Mene's patience came to an end. He had not had enough sleep. The repeated telling of the dreams, lessening in impressiveness each time he told them, had been painful. The 2 hours' wait, unnerving. Now he was so filled with the idea that these interpretations were sheer boggling and miles away from the true meaning of his visions that he could no longer control his anger. He put one more question. Did the books say the same as the wise men had said? But when they replied that their contributions were a suitable synthesis of what was in the books, together with the promptings of their own powers of combination, he sprang from his chair. During an audience that was unheard of, the courtiers shrugged and put their hands over their mouths. Mene, tears in his voice, called the fearfully startled prophets bunglers and ignoramuses. "Away with you!" he cried, almost sobbing. "And take with you, instead of the plenteous gold which my majesty would have conferred on you if truth had come out of your mouths, the disfavor of Pharaoh. Your interpretations are cheating and lies. Pharaoh knows it, for it was Pharaoh who dreamed. And even though he does not know the meaning, he does know how to distinguish between real interpretation and such worthless stuff as this. Out of my sight!" The pallid scholars were led out by 2 palace officials. But Pharaoh, without sitting down, had declared to his court that their failure would not lead him to let the matter rest. The gentleman had unfortunately been witness to a mortifying failure. But by his faith and his scepter, on the very next day he would call up other experts, this time from the house of Jehuti, the scribe of Tot, the 9-fold great lord of Khnumu. From the adepts of the white peacock was to be expected true and worthy interpretation of that which the inner voice had told him must be explained at all costs. The second hearing took place next day, under the same circumstances. It went off even worse than the first. Again, young Pharaoh, with much inward constraint, halting in his speech, made public exhibition of his dream mummies, and again, among the luminaries, there had been great nodding and then great head-shaking. Not 2, but 3 hours had king and court to wait on the issue of the private consultation. And then the experts were not even agreed among themselves, but divided as to the meaning of the dreams. 2 interpretations, the eldest among them announced, existed for each dream, and these certainly were the only ones possible, or even thinkable. According to one theory, the 7 fat kine were 7 kings of Pharaoh's seed. The 7 lean ones, 7 princes of misery who would make head against them. All this lay in the distant future. Alternatively, the fat kine might be so many queens whom either Pharaoh himself or one of his late successors would take into his women's house, and who, as indicated by the lean kine, would unhappily all die one after the other. And the ears of corn? The 7 golden ears meant, in one version, 7 heroes of Egypt, who in a later war would fall by the hand of 7 hostile, and, as shown by the thin ears, much less powerful warriors. The others stuck to it that the 7 full and 7 barren ears were children, in all 14 of them, which Pharaoh would get from those foreign queens. But quarrels would break out among them, and, thanks to superior guile, the 7 weak children would destroy the 7 stronger ones. This time Amenhotep did not get up from his seat of audience. He sat there, bent over, burying his face in his hands. The courtiers to right and left of the canopy inclined their ears to hear what he was muttering. "Oh, muddlers! Muddlers!" he whispered over and over, then beckoned to the vizier of the north, who stood nearest him, and gave him a whispered order. Ptah Emheb discharged this task by announcing to the experts in a loud voice that Pharaoh wanted to know if they were not ashamed of themselves. "They had done their best," they replied. Then the vizier had to bend over again to the king, and this time it appeared he had received the order to tell the wonder workers they were to leave the audience. In great confusion, looking one at another as though to ask whether the like had ever been known before, they departed. The court remaining stood about perplexed, for Pharaoh still sat there, bent over, shielding his eyes with his hand. When at length he took it away and sat up, affliction was painted upon his face, and his chin quivered. He told his courtiers he would gladly have spared them, and only reluctantly plunged them into pain and grief, but he could not hide the truth. Their lord and king was profoundly unhappy. His dreams had borne the unmistakable stamp of political significance, and their meaning was a matter of life and death. The expositions he had been given were ineffectual twaddle. They did not in the least fit the dreams, nor could the dreams recognize themselves in the interpretations, as dream and interpretation must recognize each other. After the failure of these 2 full-dress attempts, he was forced to doubt whether he was to be able to get any interpretation corresponding to the truth, which he would at once recognize. But that meant to be forced to leave the dreams to interpret themselves, without any preventive measures, and proceed to their evil consummation, quite possibly involving religion and the state in irreparable injury. Danger threatened the lands, but Pharaoh, to whom it was apparent, would be left alone without counsel or aid. The oppressive silence lasted for only a moment after Pharaoh finished speaking, for then it happened that Nefer Emwese, the chief cupbearer, after a long struggle with himself, came forward from the group of the king's friends and besought the favor of speaking before Pharaoh.